The Home Depot Home Improvement Show, brought to you in part by DryPro.
The Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. Answering your home improvement questions every Saturday on WPT. Presented by Charlotte Comfort Systems Heating and Air Conditioning and Acosta Heating, Cooling, and Electrical on News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WPT.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. I'm John Gordon.
I'm Dave Doble.
Good morning, Dave Doble. How are you?
I'm good, my friend. How are you?
Good, good, good. Ready for a couple hours of home improvement. Lots of good stuff this morning. Lots of questions. We'll take calls as we always do at 704-570-1110. 704-570-1110 is our number. It's been that way forever. We love it when you call. Tell us what's going on. What's on your mind? Any big stuff going on in your world? New jobs? Same jobs?
Finishing up. Same job. Just kind of an aging. It's really an aging in place, converting a living room to a master bath bedroom.
Cool. How long is that? Like, what's the length of a job like that?
About a month.
That's not too bad.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Good deal.
Good folks, good people to work for. So
that makes it always makes it a lot easier. We're ready to take some of your calls, but in the meantime, there's a handful of things that David. These are just a bunch of questions. Some of them old, some of them new. That probably have a little bit of a tail to them, if you will. Not tail, as in T A L E, but T A I L. Take a little bit of explaining in a couple of them. But it's very random, so in no particular order. But we're tackling things, a combination. A lot of focus on inside stuff. People, you know, the holidays are done. People are getting back at projects and are just not getting ready to get outside yet. I don't know what your guys' weather's going to be up there. They're talking about some maybe snow, at least snow in the atmosphere up in the mountains down here as things cool down real quickly. So. It's still February. We'll probably have 70 degree weather and we'll probably have, you know, some pretty chilly stuff. Yeah. Did you guys hit 70 already? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we'll talk about that. I don't know what's been coming in, from a questions perspective on the emails, but folks, you know, you can always send us a note at questions@askjohnanddave.com or go to askjohnanddave.com and click on the questions button. And that's a good way to get some information to us, or actually questions to us, information from us, and we're always happy to do that. David, a lot of questions as I was just kind of sorting through some things around electrical, we'll tackle them one at a time. Some are really basic, but I found myself wondering, okay, what do people want to do here, and is it something? There's a lot about electricity that's pretty basic. You know, it's not really rocket science or hard. And in a serious do-it-yourselfer that studied just a little bit could probably pull off a lot of jobs. But I'm thinking that fundamentally, and you know this better than I do, like in Mecklenburg County, Lancaster County, pretty much anything of a serious nature from a electrical perspective is a licensed electrician required job. Am I recalling that right?
Well, that is true. But I think also we just remember that in I think every state by law they have to allow you to do your own work in your own home.
Oh, okay.
But they do want you to do the work. So versus you saying that you're going to do the work and you hire someone to do it. So
okay. And then it has to be inspected, I guess. Is that the
It does have to be inspected, and some counties make you actually go in and take a for the electrical side, make you take a test. It's a 10 or 15, 20 question test just to see if you know the difference between a ground and a hot wire.
Okay.
Okay. If you don't, you figure it out pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's real-time data points that you could try. Not recommended, but you could do it. All right. I'm always, there's a question that comes up here in a little bit about generators, and the answer is no, yes, right? Officially no, but could be done legally. I think, well, I don't know. Anyway, let's get at it. But folks, 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. Somebody already did some work, right? So they ran a new circuit, a new line for an outlet, and they got all the way back to the breaker box, and there I see where the white wires go, but there's no room and there's no open spots. What do I do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
can you stack them? I don't.
Not supposed to.
That's what I thought.
Because you don't get a good bond. In the panel, so they want that screw to tighten down on that wire. So piggybacking, or double tapping into a ground or neutral bar is not really acceptable.
So, what's the alternative? What's the right thing to do? A sub panel?
Well, you could sometimes add a neutral bar if there's room underneath. You can buy them and screw them into the panel and join them together.
Okay,
but. Usually when you run out of that, if you run out of neutrals, you're running out of breaker space.
You've hit capacity on the...
So it's time for a sub panel.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I wasn't sure what the advice was on that, so good to know. Do not stack them up. All right. There's several questions related to that, but we're going to be right up against a break, so we'll go ahead and take it. Folks, this is the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. We're going to sneak away for a little break. Grab a cup of coffee, get your questions, look at the honey-do list and see what you want to have a little help with. And that would be help over the air. I don't think either one of us will be out today to do the work. Don't go away. The Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. I'm John Gordon.
I'm Dave Doble.
We have some lines open. We're at 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. Give us a call, and we'll talk about questions that are important for you. David, related to that, I guess, sort of, kind of, I came across what I think is actually a pretty healthy document. I was just looking stuff up. The question was, and Chris, actually my son, asked me this because he's got a transfer switch wired into this new house that he's got, and he wants to buy a generator for it. And he's like, Dad, really, do I have to go like whole house generator, or is there a portable generator, you know, that would run my house, you know, or most of it? And now they're down at the coast, so he didn't have the advantage of, you know, gas heat, where the heat comes from fossil fuel, and all you need is the ignition and the blower. But I looked it up, and I don't know off the top of your head if you know, but what I saw was between 5,000 and 7,000 watts will run a typical house. Does that sound right? So I mean, there's like 5,500 watt generators, 9,000 watt generators that are portable now.
Yeah, if you're mostly gas, you could do that. We could do that on our home, just because everything is, all the major appliances are gas, dryers, water heaters. I mean, they still use electricity to turn the drum on the dryer, but
right.
But that doesn't take much. So yeah, we could probably be 5,000-7,000 watts and get by, I would think.
Okay. There was a cool little worksheet that I found also. Probably I would guess Duke Energy probably has something also. I just didn't look. This was just close a link because I was messing around with numbers, and it's actually a wattage worksheet. I bet you could probably Google wattage worksheet, and it's actually pretty handy. It's got a worksheet that you could actually fill in and figure out what you need, and then it gives you reference for different, you know, things, light bulbs, heaters, humidifiers, central air conditioning, and so on, and how many watts it consumes, and it can help.
Yeah, and I think, too, I think it depends on, you know, do you want to just be able to have the TV and some lights and actually just a refrigerator or a freezer on it, and you don't really need all the conveniences.
Right.
You know, because really, I mean, for the most part, it's usually only a day or so. I mean, you know, there are times, depending on where you live.
There. We've been there.
Yeah, I have too. And, you know, that's kind of where you make that decision. That's a lot of times after somebody spends 3, 4, 5 days without power, that's when that generator talk starts.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk to Bill. Bill, good morning. You're on the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. How are you?
Good morning.
Morning.
How can we help? My house is built in 2000, and we watch a lot of them shows where they remodel and all that stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
How many years can you go before you have to upgrade your electricity? The new box and all that.
Yeah.
Well, we had that question not long ago.
Go ahead.
Well, there's articles out there that say 40, 50 years for a panel. The breakers, I guess what my response to that question was is that the breakers are what really can go bad in the panel.
Right.
Now, John talked earlier about running out of room in a panel. That tends to happen more often than the panel going bad. Now, there are some electric panels out there that are from the past that are probably not the best to keep in place that cause fires. Federal Pacific was one of them.
Right.
And then there's other panels out there that are discontinued that you can't get the breakers for anymore. So at that point, when you want to add to the panel, you may not be able to unless you add a sub panel and take away an existing circuit and move it to the sub panel. So I don't know that there's a life expectancy on them technically, but there has to be some type of life for the breakers because they are mechanical. And right. I think that's probably a legitimate answer. Now there are older houses that do need to be upgraded, but I don't think a house built in the 2000s would qualify for that.
Okay, but it wouldn't be a bad idea to maybe have somebody come in there and just upgrade that panel.
Inspect it. I don't know that there's much to upgrade, John.
I don't think so. It's actually a pretty simple system. And it's not like it is like a motor or something that has like a lot of moving parts and has wear and tear on it, right? So I think you could have it inspected if there was anything that just said, hey, I would just like a little peace of mind here, and so you can have it inspected, and that would be fine. But it's or if like you smell kind of like a burning smell or a particular part of it is hot to the touch, those would be some things. But the only thing I think that the guidance that we get is like there's a lot of people, and this happens typically more in commercial settings than in residential settings, who will use the breaker to turn lights on and off versus having them switched. That's less than optimal. It's probably not disastrous, but you wear a breaker out because now you are flipping it on and off.
Right.
But as a general rule, the components of the box, Bill, are pretty simple. And aren't going through a lot of stress in the course of their lifetime.
Yeah. And maybe one more thing to add, John, would be there was probably arc fault breakers available then, but now, like, my house was built in 2019, 2020. There are more arc fault breakers in my panel than this time than there would have been 15 or 20 years ago. So that is an upgrade that you could do, and you would talk to your electrician about that. But those breakers are more sensitive, and they can sense an arc in an appliance or any item, electric blanket or something, and it can trip the breaker. So it does make you safer. They cost more, but I mean, you know, there's technology involved in it.
Yeah.
Arc sensor breakers.
Arc fault.
Okay.
And that would be the only thing that I could think of. And then, you know, if you have GFI receptacles, they do wear out. So you could potentially replace those. And just have them look at it. There's some safety upgrades, that some things that you could change throughout the house that'll make it safer. But chances are your panel's fine unless you're out of room.
Great. Well, yeah, and I do have to replace some of them outlets, because I didn't know until really listening to y'all, some things go bad.
Can.
Well, yeah. And I think one more thing, too, is the outdoor covers. Used to be they were just a hinged lid that flipped over the switch or an outlet or receptacle. Right. Now they make what's called a bubble cover. And what that allows you to do is it allows you to plug an item in and be able to still close the outlets or close up the receptacle from weather, which is kind of nice at Christmas time or, you know, if you're running something out in the yard and you want to have it on. But it keeps the receptacle protected from moisture.
All right.
So, okay.
That's probably just a couple of things off the top of our head.
Well, I appreciate your time and I love the show.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate your call. Let's see. We got a minute. Let's see if we can get Roger, at least get the question started. Hey, Roger, good morning. You're on the Home Depot Home Improvement Show. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great.
How can we help? We've got less than a minute at least to get the question asked. And we can...
A couple of questions. The first one is I'm facing redoing the caulk in a shower, which I absolutely hate to do. It's been a couple of years. It's a little moldy right now, and I just like your recommendations. And I'm also curious about these anti-mold caulks I see in the stores these days.
Yeah. So a couple things. Redoing it, and we may have to get you through the break because there's a little bit to it, but you want to get everything out of there that's in there now. As long as it's not a silicone caulk, you can actually get a product. I think it's called Caulk Be Gone or Caulk Remover. Then it softens the caulk bead and it's easier to scrape it out. And you want to just get all of the residue scraped away and removed, vacuum it out. And then David and I like to recommend just wiping it down with some rubbing alcohol, because that alcohol bonds with the water and evaporates, and it just makes sure that your surface is really dry. There's a couple other tricks, Roger, but if you don't mind, we're going to ask you just to hold on through the break, because we're going to be right up against a hard stop that we have to take, and then we'll keep going. Is that good for you? All right. The Home Depot Home Improvement Show, taking a break. You can call us at 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. We'll talk more home improvement when we return to the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. Welcome back. This is the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. I'm John Gordon.
I'm Dave Doval.
Real quick before we sneak back to Roger and then to Worth, we'll pop our Home Depot product of the week in. This week, it's an awesome product. Again, I love it. It's the Lean Safe Fiberglass Multi-Position Ladder. Just a couple things. It can work as a step ladder, one-sided or two-sided, or a straight ladder. It goes up to 14 feet. It's fiberglass. It's light. And as a lean ladder, like leaning against the wall, if walls are unfinished, it's actually got a notch in it that accommodates a stud, so it's super safe and super stable. The price point's like $169 or so. So that's it. That's our Home Depot product of the week this week. It's the Lean Safe Fiberglass Multi-Position Ladder. Check it out. You can see it online for sure. All right, we're going to get Roger back on here. Roger, we were talking about just getting the caulk and off the tub and redoing it. And we had gotten as far as you getting everything off of there, use a caulk softener that it'll work on anything but silicone caulk. And then get it clean, wipe it down with rubbing alcohol to make sure all the water's out. Then we usually recommend that you fill the tub with water and before you start re-caulking. And the reason we want you to do that is we want pressure in the tub so that if the floor sags a little bit, it pulls down. Then you put your bead of caulk in there and let it cure, and then you can drain the tub, and then the tub comes up ever so slightly. It compresses the caulk bead versus not doing that, putting the caulk in and then filling up the tub or standing in the tub, and it sags a little bit or you pull the bond apart. So that's just a little trick. And then, David, as far as the actual product to use, we're usually recommending not to go pure silicone, but to use like a PL sealant. We've liked the DAP has a caulk adhesive combination. And what's the other one? David that was the caulk adhesive combination that I always liked.
I can't think
of the name of it. But while you're in the store, Roger, just look. A caulk adhesive combination is good, as you would imagine, because it gives you the seal of a caulk, but it's got adhesives in it, so you get a nice tight bond. And that's really it. David, I don't know if I missed anything or not, did I?
No, I think you got it pretty well covered.
Go ahead.
Roger was asking about caulk that doesn't mold. Usually, most caulk, it's mold behind it. So as John was talking about, when it separates or you get that little gap, water gets in behind it, and then it's the perfect environment for mold to grow. So it grows on it, not necessarily in it, and it's usually behind, and it shadows through. So
does that get you squared away, Roger? Maybe Roger.
No, I have a house with a brick exterior. There are steel lintels over the windows that have never been painted, and they have some rust on them. Yeah. And I would like to take care of that.
There's knock most of the, like, if there's flaking rust on there, knock that off. And then there's a product that's manufactured by Loctite. I think it's called like Rust Arrest or
Extend.
Thank you. If you spray that on the rust, with leaving some of the rust there, spray that on and then paint it, it will bond, it creates a bond with the metal, and so it stops the oxidation, and then your paint will hold up. David, the places to be most concerned, I think, is where the lintel actually gets between two bricks, because you really can't treat but the surface pointing outside, so you have to pay a little bit more attention to that.
There's not a lot you can do about that, so if you could keep the rest of it from rusting, it probably won't grow. They were probably primed.
They were
before. Yeah. So there's some primer back in where the mortar's touching the both sides of it, where it sits on the brick. So like John said, clean it up and get some rust stop on there, like Extend, and then you could paint it whatever color you want. Black is usually a good color. If you start with, I think the Extend will actually act as a primer. I'm not sure, John.
I did. I did not prime it. I put the Extend on it and then painted it, and that was adequate.
And it didn't, so it doesn't show back through. So
yeah. That was probably 10, 15 years ago. Still in good shape.
All right.
Okay. Good, I think, Roger? That's what I needed. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate the call. All right, 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. Let's get Worth here real quick. Worth, good morning. You're on the Home Depot Home Improvement Show. How are you?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Anyway, good morning to both of you. Quick question. Generac generators, there's been a lot written about them. I know the Generac, I think, supplier was over in Mooresville somewhere, went belly up, and I've read lots of negative reports on the reliability of Generac. I've also read that Samsung has come out with a new household generator that's supposed to be real good. What's your opinion, guys?
David, I would direct Worth to maybe talking to Zeke Acosta.
I can't hear you.
So I would recommend maybe talking to Zeke Acosta from Acosta Heating, Cooling, and Electrical. He does those things. Generac is, as I recall, I'm not an expert on this, Worth, but it is it is typically the manufacturer you see in municipalities and large retail places where they need to have auxiliary power for a power failure. Right. And so I don't know of any systemic or industry-wide issues with Generac. I think part of the what you want to look at is, in every generator there's a motor, an engine,
and
who makes that engine, you know, that matters. Many times it's a Kohler engine, and in fact Kohler has a line of generators. But I think I would get David, unless you can you provide more specific advice for Worth than that?
I can't, and I haven't heard a whole lot about any failures with really any generator, not on a widespread use, as you said, John, but I also haven't been searching and doing a lot of reading about it, so it would be interesting. I like your advice, and Zeke would probably be able to answer that better, worth, and let you know, because he would know if there was a problem. I just wonder if it's just certain, maybe some components or maybe a chip or a board or something in them that maybe there was a rash, there might have been some bad ones or something. But as a whole, I see those generators everywhere, and they must be doing something right.
I
agree. You know, they've been around the longest, like you say, you see them everywhere, but in the last 6 months, I've read three or four negative articles about them, and I don't, like you say, I don't know whether it's the chips or the motor or the circuitry or whatever,
right.
But it makes me hesitate. And then second, I just read a new article on Samsung's come out with a good new home generator. But no, I'll give Zeke Acosta a call.
He would be. Yeah, he would be a good visor.
I think that's the brand that they rep, and I'm knowing Zeke, he didn't take that lightly. When they picked that up, so I think he would be a good person to talk to.
Okay, I appreciate it, guys.
All right. Thanks for your call, Worth. Appreciate it, folks. We snuck past a break a little bit there, so we'll go off and do that. 704-570-1110 is the number. The Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. I'm John Gordon.
I'm Dave Doval.
We've got some lines open, 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. Give us a call. Lots of great questions this morning. David, one of the I can't remember which gentleman it was, we were talking about arc faults, and one of the questions that I had was, what is a AFCI breaker? And I think it's an arc fault current interrupter breaker. And I think you explained that it just catches when there's an arc, either in a device that could be problematic as a fire hazard, or in an outlet. I think it's required in like bedrooms and stuff like that, right?
So it's just about required in every room now.
Really?
Yeah. So they want it on the, I'm not sure if you still have to do it on the lighting circuits, but most receptacles it is on. My panels, a larger percentage of arc fault than it is standard breakers.
Really?
Yes.
All right.
It was a little shock.
They're more expensive. And I think that the solutions now are better than they were. Initially, when they first came out, they were kind of problematic, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Your volume sounds better, by the way.
Okay, I'm maxed out here, so I just like pulled the microphone. I just about got it strapped to my head.
Sorry.
I think we're good. No, I think we're good. I wanted to just hit that, and while we're at it, so arc fault and ground fault. So AFCI and GFCI, and one detects a fault, you know, a problem with arcing, and the other detects a problem when a ground with a ground. So and they each have their, you know, respective places, and it makes sense to have them. So a related question, and I tried to group these, why do my lights flicker? Why do my lights flicker? Why does somebody's lights flicker, David, as a general rule?
Well, it's almost always a loose wire connection. I mean, sometimes it can be the bulb is on its last leg, and especially a filament bulb. And then, I mean, I don't know if you've seen LEDs when they'll flash sometimes when there's a problem with them.
There's not enough current to drive it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but if you know it's not the bulb and it's flashing, a lot of times it can either be a wire in the connector. It's called a wire nut in the box. checking the panel. Our first call, Bill talked about that, about electrical upgrades. But if you get your panel serviced, that's one of the things that, that your electrician will do, is he'll take that cover off and they'll go through and he'll tighten up the neutral bar, the grounds, check the wires and the breaker to make sure that something's not loose, or, you know, they're looking for burn spots on the wire or on the insulation. Right. So, it's money well spent, I think. And I think if you've had an electrical panel for a good while, it's not a bad thing to do, especially if you combine it, John, right? With a, if you're doing something else or you're having a receptacle right. change, then ask them just to spend an extra 30 minutes or hour, whatever their charge is, to just open that panel up and take a look. And, you know, that way you can take a deep breath and, you know, that's done, it's out of the way.
Yeah. No, I think it's good advice. And kudos to the gentleman for saying, hey, I just want to make sure, right? He just wanted to make sure that there wasn't going to be an issue with it. And we think that's good advice or good thinking. Let's get Wayne. Wayne, good morning. You're on the Home Depot Home Improvement Show. How are you this morning?
Oh, fine, gentlemen. Always a good day when I can listen to you guys on the radio.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you.
Listen, I've got a townhouse I bought, and it's about 18 years old, and I just moved in here. And I noticed when I, in the bathroom, master bath, when I turn off the fan, the lights dim, you know, just for a minute, they flicker. Should I worry about that, or can I fix that by just replacing the switches?
Is it a fan-light combination?
No, it's okay. Two. Actually, that's a good question. Yeah, I think it is. Let me go double check.
Okay.
But
there's two separate switches on the wall.
Which would be correct, but it could still be part an integral unit. David, go ahead. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. That's exactly what I was just going to talk about.
So,
okay. Well, it's a small house, so I could check. Now, two separate things. The lights. Should have known this. The lights are over the sink.
Yeah.
Four bulbs, and the fan is in the ceiling.
Okay, and so the bulbs over the sink are the ones that blink or flicker when you turn the fan off?
Correct.
Okay, well, I think that sounds like just potentially a loose wire, a loose connection in that box. So when you jiggle, when you hit the switch, there's some movement. I mean, that shouldn't really happen, but that's all I could figure. I don't know why it would be anything other than that. There's a loose connection somewhere.
Yeah.
You know what? I probably should have done my homework before I called you, because I'm doing this now. The only bulb that flickers is an LED.
Ah.
There's three regular bulbs and one LED in this light fixture over the sink.
All right.
Okay.
So you're probably getting just a slight... David, I'm thinking there's just a slight dip in the current or a change in the current when one goes off, and it's enough to affect the LEDs. I think the right terminology is a driver. They have a driver in there to keep the power enough to cause the diode to glow, and which is your light. And I'm guessing
it's a motor.
I'm guessing that's what the challenge is going to be. Is going to be.
Well, that makes sense. But it's not dangerous, right? I don't have to worry about it.
No, I don't think so.
No.
Not if just one of them is doing that. So that's just the way that it's wired. Again, if you have somebody out, a handyman or an electrician, just have them pop that cover off, and they can back those switches out of that box pretty quick and just check everything to make sure.
There you go.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. I shall do that. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. We appreciate the call, Wayne. Typically, the first question, like anymore, first question, lights are flickering, is it an LED bulb? And then ensuing questions, especially if it's on a dimmer. And then it's probably a loose wire somewhere, either in the switch or along the line. All right, we are about a minute away from our first big break, top of the hour. So we'll go ahead and get ready to do that, folks. We have a lot of great questions here that we want to talk about for you. But most importantly, we want to make sure we're talking about questions that make sense for y'all. So give us a call. Get your questions ready. We're at 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. You can also go to AskJohnAndDave.com and click on the questions button. and you can send us a question that way. If you do that, sometimes helps to let us know where you are. We get a lot of questions from all over the country. So if you're not like right in the Charlotte area or in the Southeast, tell us that, because it might make a difference in how we answer questions, particularly surrounding exterior topics and things like that. So that's it. Grab a cup of coffee, get your questions ready, get ready for another hour of home improvement when we return to the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave.
The Home Depot Home Improvement Show, brought to you in part by DryPro.
A Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. Answering your home improvement questions every Saturday on WPT. Presented by Charlotte Comfort Systems Heating and Air Conditioning and Acosta Heating, Cooling, and Electrical on News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WPT.
Welcome back. Hour number two of the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. I'm John Gordon.
I'm Dave Doval.
And we, as we always do, we're taking calls, questions, 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. We've messed around a little bit in the electrical arena. I had a couple more things, David, and I had to go look this up. The question was, is it bad that my dimmer switch is hot? And the answer is no. I mean, the dimmer switch is there's a certain amount of electricity in, and it's only putting less out than because it's, you know, reading the bottom of the sine wave and just turning a light on and off to change the brightness coming out of it. So that means there's energy can't be created or destroyed. So it's got to go somewhere. It goes into heat. Now I was like, okay, how hot is hot? Cause I didn't know that. And according to the article that I read, it should be like, if it gets over 130 degrees, there's an issue. 130 degrees feels like pretty hot to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I think if you have a really hot dimmer switch, maybe change it out. I don't know. I know we have lots of good electricians listening, and so if somebody has better guidance than that, but I read 130 degrees. That just seemed pretty warm to me.
Right. Well, and I think the important part is to know what it's rated at, what wattage. So is it 600 watts, which is I think the norm. For an average dimmer. So what you do is go in and start adding up the bulbs. I think while we're at it, we should just mention that if you're using LEDs or fluorescent bulbs, you need to make sure that the dimmer's rated for those. I mean, they don't work for the most part. They tend to flicker, as we were talking about early. But you can normally just do the math, and it doesn't have to be exact. But if you're close to that, that'll give you the reason. That it's so much hot. Warmer. So what you may want to do is go to like 1,000 watt, right?
Exactly. Step it up. All right. So so that's it. Not necessarily reason to panic there, but certainly always best to be cautious or safe. I'm trying to look down my list real quick to see if that kills most of the electrical questions we have. We'll deal with them on later on if we come across it. I know the last one was, this was the one that I said the answer is no, yes. The question was, can I run a generator without a transfer switch? And we would say the answer is no, correct? I mean, you should wire a generator through a transfer switch. The truth is, you could, right? You could pull the breaker and shut your main off and run, you know, the power off of the generator into your breaker box and then choose to operate what switches you should. But you didn't hear that here, and that's not recommended for any of a number of reasons.
Well, it's more convenient to set it up so it's automatically. We had a question not long ago about that, and that was the exact advice I gave, John, was that, you know, you could run if you just want a refrigerator where you're, you know, and some people don't even mess with the breaker panel. What they'll do is they'll just run an extension cord, and that's not necessarily the best scenario either.
I think I'd pretty much just not even consider that. But that's just me being a nerd. So,
no, no. Well, I mean, there's lots of reasons. One, if the, a lot of times people will they'll get the lightest cord because it's usually cheaper. There's less copper in it, so it doesn't cost as much. So you may be running the appliance on something that's not suitable.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is you create a trip hazard. Remember, the lights are out, most likely.
True.
So, and then you have to run it through a door or a window, and you're going to close it on it, and now you take the chance of cutting the cord, possibly energizing the, if it's a metal door. Or the threshold. So just some little thoughts on that.
It is, and I think to your point, a transfer switch is not difficult to do. Again, this is one of the things I think that a consumer, a do-it-yourselfer could do, probably should have an electrician do it. But done correctly, it really makes using a generator not only safer, but just way easier, right? Because you decide in advance what circuits you're going to run with the generator, and you wire those in the transfer switch, and then you just cut your main off. That's all. You don't touch any other breakers, and then fire up your transfer switch, and away you go. Or run the generator into your transfer switch and turn those switches on, and the places that you've desired to have power now have power.
Right.
So not a bad deal, not a difficult thing. And strong recommendation is to just go ahead and bite the bullet and do the transfer switch when you put the generator in. All right, we've got some lines open, lots of lines open. 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. Give us a call. We're going to sneak away for a break here. Remember, you can send us emails at askjohnanddave.com. Click on the questions button or go to questions@askjohnanddave.com, and we can do we can get you information that way. Don't go away. The Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. I'm John Gordon.
I'm Dave Doval.
Good question so far this morning. Give us a call, 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. Switching gears. Particle board on the floor, failing in sections, parts. Wants to know how to replace just those sections. What say you?
Well, I mean, it's probably easier to do the whole room.
Boom.
At
agreed.
A time.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing you're going to have a little trouble with the height of it. It's going to be ever so slight, but chances are that particle board has taken on humidity and moisture, so it's a little thicker than the 5/8 that it was when it was originally put down. And seemed like a good idea. It was inexpensive. It was smooth and clean and made for a really nice a substrate for different products,
yeah.
but it just does, as soon as if it just hears about water, it starts to take it on, and then it's a problem.
Yeah.
So it's more than just rot. It's also a bonding issue. So if you put, I've seen this so many times, John, where the floor was wrinkled. Where vinyl floor was put over particle board floors, and that's what happens, is that the takes on a little bit of moisture from either the crawl space or just the atmosphere, and then the vinyl, the glue releases, and voila, now you have a mess.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, usually that's typically a half-inch CDX subfloor and then a 5/8 particle board. So when you go over that, they make a 5/8 underlayment grade plywood, right? And I think there's even a tongue and groove version of that. And I think our advice would be to do the underlayment grade, because in a UL grade of plywood versus just a regular 5/8 plywood, I think the first two veneers have no voids at all. That means like no little knot holes. If you see a piece of CDX, you know, you can see sometimes little black knot holes where pieces of the veneer are missing. It's not an issue for the way CDX is used. But if you had a high heel or a chair right over a place where the top veneer was, you know, intact and smooth, but there was a void beneath it, you run the risk of punching through the top veneer with a stiletto heel or or a chair. And so strongly recommend checking out to make sure that the grade of plywood that you're using is an underlayment grade. And it'll say that on the back. It'll say UL, and you know it's underlayment. All right, good advice there. The same related to floor question. Person's getting ready to put LVT down and has cracks in a basement floor, some of them uneven. What's the best way to deal with that, David?
Well, I mean, if there's just cracks, then you can put in a floor leveler, or you can go with a suppression, a crack suppression product. It's probably a little overkill for that, you don't really have to do anything for small cracks if you don't want to. Okay. I don't know how you feel about that, John, but as long as it's not raised up, that's where the problems are.
Yeah. And so when I did my mom's, there were places where, there were not cracks, but when tack strips and different things were pulled up and messed with, there was, pock marks that were deep enough in the area of the mark was enough to give me some concerns. And so I just used a floor patching compound, in there, and that worked just fine. If you do have uneven, like for whatever reason, there's a settling, so one side of the crack is a little bit higher than the other side, then I think, I mean, assuming that everything else is stable and that's not going to continue to be an issue, then I think you just grind it down, right?
Yes.
You wouldn't try to fill and kind of feather into that. You just grind the high spot down.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to fill. I mean, you almost end up doing a whole floor leveler at that point.
Yeah.
Where you pour.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Let's see. We've got Tom has a question. Good morning, Tom. You're on the Home Depot Home Improvement Show. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Thanks for all the great information.
You are welcome to it.
Okay. I had a question on painting exterior paint.
Uh-huh.
I noticed when I'm painting outside that the paint kind of, it dries out and it's kind of hard. It don't have a flow to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, are there anything that I could put in the paint to make it not dry out as quick and have a better flow, you know, smoother flow on the brush?
Yeah, you got to be careful, but there's a product, David. The latex version is Floetrol. Am I saying that right?
Correct.
And Tom, it's usually used by folks who spray the paint. So they're spraying it onto a wall using a commercial sprayer. And so they want a certain viscosity of the paint. And so that thins it out just a little bit. That's probably a terrible choice of word. It makes it less viscous. People, when you say thin paint, they feel like it, you know, somehow it's getting watered down. But I think you can put, check the label, but you can put a little bit of Floetrol in your paint bucket, and that'll slow that process down. The other thing I think you want to do, Tom, is just air is the enemy of paint until it's in the place that you want it, right? And so what I would suggest is get a smaller bucket and pour the amount of paint you're going to use into the smaller bucket. Close the top of your paint can, because if you don't do that and you open the can and leave it exposed to air over multiple periods of time, you start to have a little bit of an issue with that.
Right.
David, I don't know if there's
other
thoughts.
What's the name of that again? That stuff you said, flow.
Floetrol.
Okay.
Floetrol.
Floetrol. I took a shortcut.
Okay. I'll try that next time.
The E is silent.
Okay. Well, y'all have a great day.
All right. We appreciate your call. Thanks, Tom. Go ahead.
I just opened it up on my handy Home Depot app, and but it does talk about eliminating brush marks and roller marks. So they do use it for spray because it helps. You could spray at a lower pressure without clogging the tip, or getting the tip clogged up. But if you mix it if you're brushing or rolling, the paint just flows better. You just need to follow the directions and the recommended amount to put in. But it looks like a quart. It's almost a quart is good for 300 square feet. So I don't know if it's a quart per gallon, but.
Yeah. I mean, usually, well, like 250 square feet to a gallon, I thought. But don't quote me on that. We'll have to look, read the label. But it's a good product. And it, something my dad used to do and it wasn't related to this particular thing. And he always used oil-based paint. He would add a bit of linseed oil to it when he was painting the metal gutters and things like that. And I think the theory of the case was that actually, even after it cured, kept it a little bit more resilient, because in Chicago, the coefficient of linear expansion on a metal gutter, I mean, hot, cold, it's prone to cracking and peeling, and that was his solution, and it worked pretty well, actually. So,
right.
All right.
Yeah, we used to use, if we were painting furniture, if you were brushing it, we would, on oil base, we would mix a little bit of kerosene in there, and that works pretty well, but you can't put it back in the house for a while.
Aha. Okay. All right. So good information there. I think there was another question. There was several questions on water spots on the ceiling and wall, and then one would not keep bleeding through no matter how many coats of paint I put on. Got to seal it, right?
Yes.
So like Zinsser 123 or Kills. They make a Kills version that's latex based now. That's just a whole lot more like user-friendly, because it's just the noxious fumes aren't there that are really a problem when you use the original Kills. And that'll do the trick. And it reminded me, David, that when we talk about sprayed ceiling and having to fix, you know, water spots on sprayed ceiling, Kills Upshot is, I don't know how they do it still. I mean, how many years have we been talking about it? But they've managed to get a color that fundamentally blends in with the sprayed ceiling. So where you have a water spot, you spray it up. It's Upshot. It sprays with a can straight up, and it kills the stain and it blends in, and you don't have to paint the whole ceiling, because painting a sprayed ceiling is a pain in the backside. But it can be done. All right, we're going to be very close to a break, so we'll get ready to take it. We've got time. Call us. We've got lines open, 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110, or askjohnanddave.com. Click on the questions button, and we'll talk about home improvement either by email or by phone. Don't go away. The Home Improvement Show is coming back after these important messages. Welcome back. This is the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. I'm John Gordon.
I'm Dave Doval.
704-570-1110, 704-570-1110. Give us a call. We got some lines open. We're going to do our Home Depot product of the week. This week, it's the Lean Safe Fiberglass Multi-Position Ladder. It can be used as a step ladder, and actually you can use it as a single-sided step ladder or two-sided step ladder, so you can have two people on the ladder working at one time. It's fiberglass, it's non-conducting, it's sturdy. It's a multi-position ladder, so it can go from step ladder to straight ladder, and it's straight, it has a 14-foot reach, and you can switch it. David, sometimes flipping those multi-position ladders is a bit of a hassle. Single lever switches it from step ladder to straight ladder. So super easy to work with. And it's got a little notch in the top. If you're using it leaning against a wall in new construction where studs are exposed, there's a notch in the top of the ladder that fits right over a stud. So it's super stable. So just a great product all around. And it's about $169. Check it out at homedepot.com or your local store. All right. 704-570-1110. We've been talking about all kinds of different things. We just finished up some cracks in concrete. We were on paint with the gentleman, and the age-old question was out there, can I put latex paint over oil-based paint? For a while, the message was, no, you just can't do that. But I don't think that's correct. Is that right, David? Prepping the surface, you can go ahead and go over it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you probably have to sand the surface, just knock the gloss off of it. You're not trying to, you know, do this aggressive sanding on it, but you want to knock the gloss off of the surface, and then you can put a latex based paint on a surface that has been prior painted previously with an oil based product. So that's really not the end of the world. Then we talked about the water spots. Paint won't stick to the trim. I think we just answered that. Yeah? Isn't it usually like, well, it could be one of two things, right? It could be that it was an oil-based product, or it was a high gloss product. Either way, you're going to have to knock the gloss off of it, and then you can do your paint.
Right. Well, two choices, right? So you could put a coat of gripper, or because you could put gripper and Zinsser 123, that'll go directly over ceramic tile or correct. A mirror glass. So I guess you have to make that choice. Do you sand a little bit, or do you use the no sand, or do you put a coat of primer? Figure out what how much time is each going to take and go from there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Painting is kind of like, it's like the law of conservation of energy. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. For painting, it's the law of conservation of time. It's going to take a certain amount of time. And do you want to do it, spend the time taping and paint a little faster? Do you want to, clean up? What do you want to do? But it's going to take some amount of time to do what you got to get done. And I don't know. I guess that's our opinion. That's for what it's worth. All right. Looks like we got some calls coming in. We'll let Chris get at those. I meant to bring this up when we were talking to the gentleman who had the tub caulk question. Let's go. We'll get Ron first, and then I'll bring this back up. It's a mold question also. Ron, good morning. You're on the Home Depot Home Improvement Show. How are you this morning?
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I have two questions, actually, kind of a combination question and then another question. I built a deck out of treated lumber, and it's elevated, and it's trimmed out with hardy plank underneath. My question is, I want to paint it, not the deck itself, but the railings and everything around it. Should I use an oil-based paint or a latex paint? How long should I wait since it's treated lumber? And can I use the same paint on the hardy plank as I do on the wooden parts?
Treated lumber, painting it, I guess I'm just curious. That's going to mean a lot of maintenance, right? You understand that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. So when to paint or seal treated lumber, depending on how hot and rainy it's been, if it's been dry for a period of time, you can just I'll put a drop of water on the surface, and if the water is drawn in, it's ready to be painted. As far as the type of paint to use, strongly recommend a latex-based paint versus an oil-based paint. Latex-based paints stay flexible after they cure. So as that wood expands and contracts as it takes on moisture and gives off moisture and so on, it'll prevent issues with peeling and cracking and so on. So that's probably that's the product that you would want to use for in that scenario. David, what'd I forget?
Nothing. I mean, you talked about the maintenance of it. So, I guess it doesn't matter if you're staining or painting. I think paint tends to show up a little bit quicker if it's a lighter color, when you're painting over treated lumber. I would almost think about applying Cedar Shield. It's a wood stabilizer, and what that'll do is exactly what John was talking about. That'll stop the expansion and contraction of that wood, because the wood will no longer be able to take moisture on. And once you stop that, then the paint's going to hold up better, because it doesn't have a couple of the things that are going on with paint. One, if the wood's expanding and contracting, it's always moving that paint, stretching it, and contracting. When the wood is allowed to take on moisture and then give it back off. So what it eventually does is it breaks the bond of the paint to the surface, and now you have more chance for failure. So if you can eliminate that, then all you have to deal with is just, the sun or just the elements themselves deteriorating the surface of the paint.
Right.
And it's not from underneath. So, you know, it may be worth it. Just you might want to look it up. Cedar Shield. There's a link on our site to it, but you can also go to cedarside.com and check that out. If you have a lot of area, it's cheaper to buy it in the 5-gallon containers than it is in the 1-gallon containers.
Well, that makes sense. My wife wants it painted white to match the rest of the house trim. So.
Sure.
Yeah, understand.
And my second question, thank you. So I'm on a well, and how do I check my tank, my pressure tank? It's been there for 15 years, and when I take a shower, it's like a jet engine winding up. You know, I can hear it go, the water coming out a whine, and then it'll be fine for 15 seconds, and the pressure will go down, and it'll do it again, like the pump coming on and off too quick. Mm-hmm. How can I pressure check the tank to make sure that it's not filled with water or bloated?
Well, you could check the pressure with the gauge, and it should tell you on there what it's set at. Sometimes they'll write it on there, but I think it's like 7 or 8 PSI for the bladder. But make sure you just look on there. It'll tell you what the max is. A lot of times
I have a gauge. I have actually a gauge, and it's between 45 and 60.
Right. So what I think your problem is you know where the pressure switch comes off of the T at the bottom of the tank?
Just had it replaced.
Okay. Did they replace that nipple underneath? That
No, I don't believe so.
That's what needs to be replaced because it's usually galvanized and they get clogged up, and it'll cause you to have intermittent readings and it messes with the pressure switch is what it does.
Perfect.
So surprised they didn't change that. If they took the pressure switch all the way off, it's pretty easy to remove it at that point.
I will. I'll get that done and see if it fixes the problem. Thank you so very much. I watch. I listen to your show every week, and you guys have saved me a ton of money and work.
Great.
So thanks.
Good deal. Thanks, Ron. All right, we got to sneak off to a break. Went way past it, Matt. We see you out there. We're going to catch you right after these important messages. Welcome back. This is the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. I'm John Gordon.
I'm Dave Doval.
And we are in the lightning round. We're going to talk to Matt. Good morning, Matt. You're on the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave. How are you?
Hey, doing great, guys. Good morning. Love the show. Listen to it every week. My question is about a toilet that's leaking. I mean, every few minutes it's kicking on, putting more water into the tank.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, the flapper. I replaced the flapper. It didn't fix the problem. And there's no evidence of any water leaking on the floor or anything. So I just decided to replace everything, went and got one of the complete kits to replace all the internal parts, which it did fix the problem. The toilet is not leaking now. It's not kicking on, sending more water into it. The thing I can't figure out, though, is since I replaced all the internal parts, there's hardly any water in the bowl. I mean, it doesn't even nearly come up to the top of the opening in the bowl. It's just a very, very small amount of water that is in there each time I flush it, and I can't figure that out.
Is the tube in the back, the fill tube for the bowl, is the hose down in it all the way?
Yeah, from everything I can see, yes. Yes, it is.
And it's not.
I'm actually
not
driving now, not at home. I would have to take another look at it. I believe so. Yes.
So a couple things to look at when you take the tank lid off. Make sure that hose is not crimped, because that is actually where the bowl gets filled up is through that tube. So the little hose that's connected, or it's usually they come with a little clip so that they can't. Pressure themselves out or move, and so you need to make sure when you flush that toilet, when the water's flowing, that water is in fact coming out of that hose.
Okay, I will definitely take a look at that. That's just something I've never seen before. I've replaced a lot of, done a lot of those types of small repairs, but I've just never seen this before. So I will take a look at that then.
Okay,
that should be the cure for it.
Okay, great. Appreciate it, guys. Thanks
for the call, Matt. All right, let's talk to Clyde. Clyde, good morning. You're on the Home Depot Home Improvement Show. How are you this morning?
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
Great.
I just caught the tail end a while ago when you were talking about putting a transfer switch in for a generator.
Yes.
Now, I tried that one time running a couple of lines in here, and that didn't work out well. But where would you put the transfer switch? Would it be in the box or next to the box or where?
Next to the box, typically, Clyde. There's some are vertical, some are horizontal, but typically you would get it relatively close to the box. It's not super critical that it be right next to the box. It's just then you're going to have to run conduit from wire from the transfer switch into the box. So the closer you get it, the better off you are.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, it would be, it's on the inside, and it would be as close to the box as you can get it. And of course, in a place where there's easy access.
Okay. Now, would you once that's done, you turn the main off, and then can you just plug the thing into any receptacle, and it'll go from there?
So when you turn the main off, you plug the cord into the generator at the output, and then into the transfer switch.
Oh, okay. It goes into the transfer.
Right. There's typically David, it's like a 30-amp connector, I think, that comes out. And so you'll have that, and then it'll be a conductor that goes from that point into the transfer switch. And then that runs your power. So when you turn your main off, then the transfer switch, you've selected which of the circuits inside your box you want to have run by the generator, and you've wired those circuits to the transfer switch so that when you turn the switch at the transfer switch on or off, it turns power on or off to that particular circuit.
Okay.
And then you should be good to go. Not take a minute to think. It takes a minute to think about it and get it right on the front end, but it's a pretty simple thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, this generator has four 110s and one 220, so okay. I would just figure out which circuit goes where and go from there.
You got it.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks for the help. That's really great, and I appreciate it.
No worries. Appreciate the call.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Have a great one. Bye, Clyde. All right, we are time goes by awful fast. Want to sneak
got a
up.
Couple.
Go ahead.
Quick emails.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's just. I think they're listening. So, Gregory writes in, wanted to know what the cover for the spray cover we talked about for ceilings, John.
Okay, spray cover for ceilings.
For killing stains.
Oh, a Kills Upshot. Is that what he's after?
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Kills.
Go ahead.
Kills Upshot. So that claim to fame was what John was talking about is old ceiling yellow. Yeah. It tends to blend in. You can tell from an angle if you look at it that it's been sprayed, but usually the color is a pretty good match. So it's worth it. It's in the paint aisle at Home Depot or wherever you shop. You'll be able to find it, and it sprays up, which is great, which is why they call it Upshot. Makes it a lot easier to use. And then John from York County. We don't have any more calls, do we?
No, we're good.
Okay. I don't have a call screen here. So anyway, John lives in York County, and he said his water heater is 16 years old. He's replaced the expansion tank and the thermal couple, but he wondered how much longer should he let that water heater ride. We had that question a couple times
last week, it's
at its life expectancy or beyond it. So, you may want to start thinking about getting some prices on that and budgeting for it and be ready. It's better. We always say it's better to change it on your terms than when it goes out. 'Cause it's never at a convenient time. That's for sure.
Exactly.
And then he had a second question. The vacuum cleaner, when he plugs it in at the top of the stairs, trips the breaker every time. Chances are there's arc fault breakers, what it sounds like, John,
yeah, and that exactly.
it doesn't recognize the device. So you may want to have them look at that arc fault breaker and see if they can cure that. That's about all you can do.
All right. Boom. Perfect. And that's perfect timing. It's time to move on. Folks, thanks so much for being with us this week. I always appreciate your great questions and your checking in. We each week like to remind you that we think that the most important kind of home improvement that you can make is the one that makes your home a happier place to live in. As you work on all the other projects going on this week, don't forget to work on that one. And we'll see you next week when we return to the Home Depot Home Improvement Show with John and Dave.